This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Abdeen Jabara, the former president of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee and a lifelong Palestine solidarity activist. With the situation in Egypt changing rapidly, Jabara will discuss the various options the United States has to keep the process of democratization within bounds. Yeah, something happened.
We talk with the founding editor of The Independent.
He'll talk about his newest article, The American Dream as We Know It is Obsolete, why progressives need to think beyond the mantra of creating a middle-class America.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Over 500 friends and comrades of Len Wineglass, the greatest movement lawyer of his generation, met to say farewell to Len on May 13th at the Ethical Cultural Society of New York. Amongst the speakers were Ramsey Clark, Tom Hayden, Marty Garbus, Kathy Boudin, and Phyllis Menes. We'll hear excerpts from some of the tributes paid to Len from that great evening. You can also link to the entire memorial service on our website, lawanddisorder.org. The clouds that were lowered on us have been dissipated a bit by this evening. I'm grateful for it, and I'm really grateful for what Kathy Boudin, she's making up for lost time, what Kathy's been able to do. When I was talking last week with our next speaker, who many of us consider a national treasure, I said to him, "What would you like me to say by way of introduction for you?" And he said, in his soft drawl, "Well, part of the country I come from, we say, you can tell them who I am, but don't tell them where I'm at." Ramsey Clark.
We are the lucky few, those whose lives have been touched by Lenny. The word nobility comes to my mind. I don't believe in royalty, but noble principle, dedication, and modesty. I first met him on a cold December Sunday, 1969. Bill Kunstler and a couple of the defendants, I don't believe one of them was Tom, but in the Chicago 7 case came out to the house in the suburbs of Washington to ask me to be a witness in the trial. And I told him I would. I would want to. I got out there and we wasted about 2 days trying to get me on the stand, and the judge ruled that my testimony would be cumulative, which is a pretty ridiculous ruling because we'd spent a lot of time in the summer of 68 with Civil Rights Division and Community Relations Service and other people trying to cool it in Chicago. And we thought we knew where the trouble really came from. Mayor Daley had said earlier this summer, when after Dr. King's death, that they were going to shoot looters. We had to say, you shoot looters and you'll be prosecuted by the federal government. And that was the spirit of the times when that demonstration occurred. The trial went on, and finally there was another trial that you don't hear so much about, called the trial of the Chicago 10 for contempt of court. During the trial of the Chicago 7 trial for standing up for the United States of America. And the 10 were the 7 plus Bobby Seale, who had been separated from the case brutally, and the two lawyers, Len and And Bill, Len was cited in 14 separate counts of contempt and sentenced on them. It was all an honor. We created a counter-convention called Peace Through Martial Law because it was a time of Marcos and his brutal regime. We were down in Nicaragua during the Contra fight, and Lynn was always relaxed, good-natured. He knew that any fool can be unhappy and nothing could make him unhappy. Because he knew that he was doing what he believed in, and he knew he was doing it with important and great effect.
Our next speaker is Phyllis Bennis, comes to us from Egypt. She works for the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written a number of very fine books and articles, and I'm sure you will be hearing about her report from Egypt. But before she started doing what she's doing, she worked closely with Len for many, many years, doing jury selection advice, doing investigations, and then she got her current job. But she's going to come talk to us about what it was like to work with Len in the old days.
What an extraordinary opportunity for us to celebrate such an extraordinary life. I want to thank Michael and Debbie and Kathy and Julie and Scott and everybody who worked on the event tonight. You know, I don't know how many of you know, but yesterday the U.S. government took an action that I kept thinking, did they know about this? And then I remembered who I was thinking about. They decided, it was announced yesterday, to declassify the Pentagon Papers. 40 years. And now we can read the Pentagon Papers. As if it had not been used as a teaching tool all these years. I first met Lenny as a young, almost student. At the time of the Pentagon Papers trial, there was the Pentagon Papers Peace Project running around trying to use the information in the papers to educate people about the war in Vietnam. It was tied to the Indochina Peace Campaign that I was working with. Lenny became sort of my older brother in L.A. I used to house-sit for him in Echo Park and take care of Kiefer, the dog that was Luca's grand dog, if we can say that. And I went off to South Dakota with the Lawyers Guild to, among other things, work on some of the Native American cases, the AIM cases out of Wounded Knee. And I learned to do jury investigation there. And when I came back, I started working with Lenny on a number of the cases, the Skyhorse Mohawk trial, Bill and Emily Harris's case, the SLA case, and I don't know how many cases of Iranian and Vietnamese and Palestinian student protests in LA where Lenny took up the role of lead counsel, and I was usually sort of the trial wrangler of keeping all the defendants in trying to talk to each other. It wasn't easy in those days. And it was an extraordinary moment. It was a time when trials really were part of the political mobilization of the movements that were sweeping this country and indeed the world. And then I spent 21 years with Lenny as part of the legal team of the Los Angeles 8 Palestinian deportation case. We won after 21 years. It was the longest case in immigration history. In that case, there were a lot of lawyers involved at the beginning. There were 50 or 60 lawyers involved. We talk about wrangling defendants. I had to wrangle lawyers in that period. But after a few years, it was sort of pared down to a small team. And it was an extraordinary group of lawyers who worked on that case, Lenny at the core. In the meantime, I had become a private investigator largely because one day after court, Lenny said to me, "Why don't you get a license so we can get you appointed on these cases and get you some money?" And I remember saying to him, a license as what? And he said, as a private investigator. And I said, "You can do that?" I thought that was sort of just in the movies. But I went, I got my license, kept my license for 30 years. And I was the investigator on the LA 8 case. That case, for those of you who don't remember, it was very much a throwback to the McCarthy era. This was a case that had very serious constitutional issues about freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, whether non-citizen immigrants would have any rights in this country. Very crucial, complicated legal issues at stake. But the only thing the judge would ask us at the beginning of every trial day in Los Angeles is, Mr. Weinglass going to be attending this session?
You just heard excerpts from the memorial meeting for the great civil rights movement lawyer, Len Weinglass. We're very pleased to have with us in the studio today Abdin Jabara, a Lebanese-American, the former president of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, and an activist for over four decades in Palestine solidarity work, and a civil rights lawyer who's a member of the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He joins us to discuss his evaluation of the relationship of forces within Egypt and America's struggle to control and contain the process of democratization in Egypt. Abdin Jabara, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Egypt is the main concern of the American government and what kind of policy they're going to pursue. And I wanted to ask you, first off, what your assessment is of the situation in Egypt now, and the related question, what is America's concern?
Well, I think the situation in Egypt is very much in flux. How this ultimately plays out will depend on a number of different factors, many of which we cannot really predict. There has been a breakdown of law and order to some extent in Egypt. There's been an enormous rise in the crime rate. There's been sectarian clashes. There has been a huge drop in the income from tourism. The Egyptian government has been spending a great deal of its foreign reserves to buy food for the people. There have been strikes in various factories. Even the police went on strike, demanding higher wages. There have been people who have broken out of various prisons. So the situation is very much in flux. What the United States is concerned about is seeing a transition, and they use that word, from the Mubarak era to an era which has a controlled democracy. When I say controlled, I mean by that a democracy in which two sections of an Egyptian elite maintain some kind of control over popular forces.
I mean, do you see any signs of two sections of the elite contending right now in Egypt?
Well, what I see, yes, I do. I mean, one of the main... By the way, there have been a number of people who have been coming from Egypt to the United States, have been giving interviews to the Wall Street Journal, who have been meeting with the New York Times. One gentleman whose name is Soweris, who owns Oriscom, which is the Egyptian cell phone conglomerate and is one of the wealthiest men in Egypt, he was supportive of this revolution. And of course, these people want to make sure that their interests are protected. So there were different segments of the industrialists and the moneyed classes. There were those that were the nouveau riche that were being promoted by Gamal Mubarak, who was the son of Hosni Mubarak. And many of them actually have been arrested and are in jail for ill-gotten gains. And that is one of the most positive aspects of what has developed after this revolution, is that there is some effort at accountability against the most venal elements of the old Egyptian ruling class, if you will. Then, of course, there is the other segment of it that wants to make sure that their interests are protected, but they want to also be supportive of some change and opening up of Egyptian society to some extent so that they can continue in the process that they've been in. you know, one of the real serious problems of Egypt has been this neoliberal development, where they were trying to sell off state-owned businesses.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because under Nasser and his brand of, quote, Arab socialism, there were a lot of Egyptian wealth was nationalized and run by the government. The Suez Canal, of course, is the great example, but a lot of other industries as well that were steadily sold off by the Mubarak dictatorship.
Well, it began with Sadat. It began with Sadat in what was called the open door policy. This open door policy, it was called infitah in Arabic, was a policy that was to go hand in hand with Sadat's attempt to reshift Egypt from its alignment with the socialist bloc to an alignment with the United States and to become more or less of a proxy for the United States in the region. And this was done in part with the connivance and the support of the Saudis, this infitah policy. They were pushing Sadat to do this. They wanted Egypt to become part of the Western, so-called Western camp, if you will. So this has been an ongoing policy for a number of years that predated Mubarak. Now, Gamal Mubarak, who was the son, he and his brother are now under arrest. He had taken this even further, where he was bringing in all this Western capital to purchase businesses at cut rate prices.
And then he would be
He would get a partner.
Yeah,
exactly. It was a very cozy arrangement.
Yeah.
Now, Mrs. Mubarak, only this past week, had been arrested, and she has given up $4 million.
Yeah, she said she'd give some back, but $4 million is a drop in the bucket, I would imagine.
No, but you've got to start someplace. That's so I think that there's some very positive developments, but it's also very worrisome, because the question really is there going to be fundamental change, or is it going to be merely a reshuffling in a cosmetic fashion so that there's no real change in the basic relationships with the people?
Yes.
That is the real issue, all right? And I think a lot depends upon the army. In fact, I think all of it depends upon the army. And it depends upon what the United States and Western countries are going to do. Egypt is a very poor country, and its main sources of income other than tourism, of course, are the Suez Canal, finished clothes products, and canned goods that they export. So I think that we are going to have to see whether or not the army is able to manage the situation as this new government comes into place. Several people have announced that they would be running for the president. Amr Moussa, who was the head of the Arab League and who is an old Arab nationalist, has announced that he would run, as has somebody from the Muslim Brotherhood who has announced, and they have support. And the reality is a situation in every one of these countries where there is this uprising or so-called Arab Spring, the Islamist forces are going to play a role. This was always used by these dictators to gain support in the West by saying that if you allow us to falter, this is what's going to happen. Well, they did not do so well recently in elections at the university level and among the students, but they have to be able to be given an opportunity to participate and put forth whatever their program is. And I think that we'll see whether or not they make any inroads. And if they don't deliver, of course, other forces. The secularists, to the extent that they are people who have been aping the West, who have been allied with Western values and Western culture, et cetera, and have primarily seen themselves as part and parcel of a Western civilization, I think that they will alienate themselves from the mass of the Egyptian people. For instance, if you take Tunisia, Tunisia is a really interesting case because along the coastline, you have people who first language, many of them, first language is French, and they look to Europe, et cetera, et cetera. But in the hinterland, in the places where Bouazizi set himself on fire, these are traditional Tunisian societies. They have much more traditional values. And there's going to be that kind of conflict. The same thing exists in Egypt between a small Western-oriented class of who are involved in arts and education and business and the mass of the Egyptian people.
Well, let's talk about the mass of Egyptian people. The average wage for almost half the Egyptian people is less than $2 a day. A large impetus for the uprising in Egypt came from these poor people, particularly in the industrial areas. But there have been draconian laws that suppress their ability to speak out, to organize, to have unions. Those laws have not been lifted, as far as I can tell. And I wanted your assessment of what these elements of the Egyptian workers have been able to accomplish so far.
The April 6th movement is a movement that developed from strikes that were going to be held in April 6th of 2009 in an area called Mahalla, where there are large factories. Those strikers were arrested by the government. By the way, under the Mubarak government, the head of the trade union movement was a minister in the government. It's absolutely incredible. This people should understand, and that in order to go on strike, you had to get permission from the executive council of the trade union movement in order to go on strike.
Yeah.
So there were limitations, but they fought. They went to court. They got a ruling from the courts that it was legal to strike, and there's been a history of very militant labor strikes in Egypt, some of which were legal and some of which were not. So definitely since we've seen the fall of Mubarak, you've seen much more labor activism, much more of a people demanding increases in their wages, having more sense of an entitlement to better wages and standard of living. So I think that this is a very positive thing, and we will see how this develops over time in terms of the role that organized labor plays in Egypt.
Are there any political formations that are putting together that kind of a progressive program and making those kinds of demands, or that will assert themselves in the upcoming elections?
Well, I believe that there are. I mean, I have not been there, and I have not really been able to follow it as closely as I would like to have. I am sure that there are a number of forces now at play that are in the process of organizing and who will advance candidates in the upcoming elections. And we will see when those elections turn out what the constellation of forces are. Of course, some of them have had much more opportunity in the past to have some kind of a organization on the ground, like the Muslim Brothers. They are much more entrenched in the society, and then labor was allowed. But there are other forces, and I think that we will be seeing the United States and some of the European countries will be pouring money in to support various formations in the country as well.
Let's shift the discussion a little bit to Egypt's neighbor to the north, Israel. The United States poured more money into Israel than any other country in the world except Egypt. And now there's kind of a reluctance on the part of the Egyptian leadership to be too pro-Israeli. There's even talk that they're going to open up the passage from Egypt into the Gaza Strip, and there's quite a lot of popular support in Egypt for the Palestinians. What do you think the United States is going to do in terms of keeping its ties to both Israel and Egypt at the same time?
Well, we just had a forum at the Egyptian mission to the United Nations this past Friday. And as an introduction to that forum, the deputy head of mission at that place made a statement about Egyptian policy regarding the two-state solution. And the statement that he made was no different than what Egyptian policy has historically been, which is a two-state solution with the Palestinians having their capital in Jerusalem. Now, but I think there is a difference. And Nabil El Arabi, who is the new foreign minister, told the Palestinians that he's interested in peace and not a peace process, which is very interesting because what the Americans and the Israelis have always talked about is a peace process, which has been with much more emphasis on process than on peace.
Well, to the extent that it's really been a sham. I mean, there's been
exactly
no progress
what it has been.
Process.
What it has been is a process to extract more and more concessions from the Palestinians and from the Arabs in general. That's what the peace process has been all about. I think that we're going to see something totally new now. I mean, with all this turmoil, and particularly with the Palestinians that have now attempted to breach the armistice lines in Syria, in Lebanon, in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank. This was a major, major development on the occasion of the anniversary of the Nakba. And it has excited the people of the region and the people in the Third World. We have to understand that now, today, the Europeans have been developing some distance from the United States on the whole Middle East issue, and that the United States and Israel are really becoming more and more isolated in the world. This is what the United States was worried about, the Goldstone Report, that this matter would go to the Security Council and it would have to veto the referral of the matter to the International Criminal Court. This is what they told Judge Goldstone. You shouldn't have had that as one of the requests in the report, that it be go to the Security Council. You know, there's a saying in Arabic, which I won't say in Arabic, but it says two asses in the same pair of drawers. That's what, as far as I'm concerned, Israel and the United States are. The United States has never been an honest broker in this situation, but now they're faced with a whole new reality in the region, and it's going to be very interesting to see how Obama, who has not been much of a leader, even though he has a lot more possibility now that they have killed Osama bin Laden, he has he's being lauded and applauded. You would think that he would take some bold new initiative on the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but that's not going to happen.
I don't think so either, and I don't think that Netanyahu, when he comes here to speak, and he's getting ready, is going to take any bold new initiative either. My judgment is that they'll just hope against hope that things will just continue and continue.
Exactly. This is really what the problem has been, is that the United States has carried so much water for Israel over the years, and the Palestinians have been squeezed and placed in a situation that has been really quite extraordinary by the United States. And that's why the Palestinians are going to the to the General Assembly in September for recognition of Palestinian statehood.
We had the chance to interview Omar Barghouti 2 weeks ago on the boycott, divest, and sanction movement. And I wanted to ask you, in the context of that, what's your evaluation of the flotilla that's being organized, particularly the one from the United States, to try to break the siege of Gaza?
Well, I've been involved in that whole effort somewhat. I was on the selection committee of people who will be going on the American boat, and it is very, very exciting because this flotilla, which will leave in the latter part of June and have in it some 10 boats from different European and North American countries, including Canada, is a real effort at grassroots attempts to change the equation. That is how this flotilla should be looked at. And there's going to be a fundraiser for the flotilla this coming week on the 25th. There's going to be a boat that's going to be sailing here in the East River.
From the dock on, I think, 23rd Street in the East River.
23rd Street, exactly.
At what time?
At 6:30.
And people could come down and get tickets and get on it?
Tickets are $25. I encourage people to contact the people who are organizing this. They can go to the website, ustogaza.org.
ustogaza.org, this coming Wednesday, and that's May
25th.
25th.
It's going to be a wonderful event. People have been putting this whole thing together, have been just absolutely amazing. They've worked tirelessly, night and day. They've been operating in a very organized and efficient fashion, and I'm so proud of them for what the work that they're doing.
Abdeen, do you have any last thoughts you want to share with us?
Well, number one, I want to thank you and Law and Disorder for all the attention that you've given to this and other matters that are of such vital importance to the American people and to people around the world. And that's the last thing I would like to say. I think it's just been wonderful.
Well, thank you, Abdeen Jabara, for being on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Founding editor of the newspaper The Independent, Arun Gupta, joins us today to talk about the arc of American economic development since World War II and why it's an obsolete strategy to think that we can rebuild a prosperous middle class. Arun makes the point that the definition of middle class is really a definition of a lot of consumption, something that the upper strata of American workers enjoyed from the end of World War II up until about 1980. With respect to tactics and strategy, he zeroes in on the situation in Wisconsin and makes the point that steering the movement into a recall of 8 Republican senators and some Democrats come next November is a dead end, and that what should have been done and what must be done is a broad organizational effort for a general strike. This situation no longer obtains.
Arun, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Arun, you had in the April 6th issue of The Independent, which you edit, a really clear-headed analysis in an article that you entitled The Case Against the Middle Class. And in it you say, the middle class, what does that mean? You dissected the real situation in this economy perfectly. We're so happy to have you on Law and Disorder. Welcome. Let's talk about the real situation in this country and get rid of these foggy ideas about the middle class.
It really started to bug me when I kept hearing all these progressives and labor leaders, Richard Trumka, people like Jim Hightower, a lot of progressive publications like Mother Jones saying we need to defend the middle class. The middle class is under attack. We need to reinvigorate the middle class. And I've been studying the Tea Party a lot recently, and so it started to bother me on a number of levels because, first of all, is the middle class really under attack? It's a segment of the middle class that's under attack. That dependent on public service unions. As I point out that the Tea Party, the core of it is very much middle class. It tends to be more entrepreneurial, the more management supervisory roles that we see historically in the Republican Party.
Slow down for one
Party.
Second. When you said it's a segment of the middle class that's under attack, just mm-hmm. expand that a little bit and then
basically, those who are dependent through the public sector. So it's government workers. We have to understand there's kind of a dual movement going on with the Republican attack that isn't often linked. It's the social welfare is being attacked, and so is public sector jobs, but we don't really link that. What the Republicans are doing is they're attacking those who carry out these policies, who implement the social welfare policies. So there's a clear link between the two. And I was surprised to find out that, say, in Wisconsin, it's not a very big state. I forget what the population is, maybe around 5 million. There are 200,000 public sector jobs. And that's a huge part of the population, especially when you consider, you know, how many people are dependent upon them. That probably amounts to about 10% of the population is directly dependent on public sector jobs. So it's the public sector that is very much under attack, and that is clear. I'm not saying that, oh, we should abandon them. Rather, we need to expand our notion of who are we defending and what are we fighting for, because I think we've already been through this scenario before. And you especially see it with Paul Krugman, who has just these really loopy ideas about the 1950s.
The golden age of his childhood.
Yeah,
you know, you have to expand this a little bit, because you mentioned now some of the heroes of people who listen to this station.
Right.
You know, Hightower, Krugman, and others. And so
I think Krugman is the most egregious. He actually says that the 1950s was an era without great extremes of wealth and poverty.
I just read that recently, actually.
And I'm like, really? There were no Rockefellers or Mississippi sharecroppers in the 1950s? I mean, that's just absurd. You know, his emotions are triumphing over his reason. There was some substantive differences. Let's not forget that. The tax rate was 91%. But what I'm looking at more is the intersection of a political economy and ideology. One, I argue that the middle class, it's a consumptive class. But in terms of political economy, how do we understand the 1950s? We actually have to go back to the New Deal in terms of corporatism. Corporatism refers to a political system. Corporatism does not mean corporation. It's derived from corpus, meaning body, where the idea is that the government is a neutral mediator between significant sectors of society, business, labor, agriculture, the military, whatever are the dominant forces. Mussolini, the Italian fascism was a corporatist society. There's an argument that Nazism was a corporatist. And New Deal was very much corporatist. That's what the Taylor Law was about.
One, the New Deal was corporatist. So what does that mean? And what is the Taylor Law?
Well, the Taylor Law is what brought collective bargaining into being.
That's the one that said that public unions couldn't strike. You're saying that's the one thing I take away
right.
from it, but
well,
you're saying it was the beginning of putting boundaries on negotiations or actions by labor unions you're about to lead us into the next law. But I just want that's what you're essentially saying on that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, that's an important part of that, the restrictions on public sector unionism. But the Taylor Law was about private sector unionism. But the thing that's important to understand about corporatism, in other words, where the FDR was bringing together labor and business in a compact, was that American capitalism really needed the domestic market. It was vital in terms of its profit-making capacity. It hadn't internationalized to the degree it has today. So business had an interest in terms of engaging in a pact with labor. And that's what's completely changed today, you know, where I
because
say,
they needed to have consumers here to buy their product.
What we had in this country in this golden age of American capitalism was a essentially a labor aristocracy. In other words, people were getting paid very well in this country because it depended upon imperial conquest in the Third World to bring cheap commodities in, not in terms of consumer markets that we're starting to see grow up today in countries like Brazil, Nigeria, India, and most of all China. But it was about, you know, bringing in tin from Bolivia, copper from Chile, rubber from Indonesia, bananas from Guatemala, for having these access to real, and of course oil from the Middle East, having access to very cheap commodities that subsidized American capitalism and subsidized the middle class lifestyle. You know, we forget this. Like, Krugman never talks about the fact that the 1950s was an era where, you know, I wasn't alive, but we know it's an era where society lived under the terror of imminent nuclear war. It was a society of massive militarization. Of course, not that much has changed in terms of today.
It's changed. It's worse.
Yeah.
Post-World War II, and Roosevelt, actually, there's a domestic agreement that corporations needed internal consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And what you seem to be saying, at least I think where you're going, is we may not need it anymore.
Corporations don't need it.
Corporations don't need it. That's what I'm saying. Corporations don't need internal consumption anymore to sell their products.
Right.
And when you mention, and I'll just give this as an example, when you mention the internal system of roadways throughout the country that were built post-World War II, all the freeways, and I now think about, well, why don't we have high-speed trains going to Cleveland, Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh? It seems obvious to me that that's necessary to build up this country economically. But the analogy would be to those super roads, but they don't need it because they don't need internal consumption anymore. They don't care about it. I mean, I don't know. You don't have to tell me whether I'm right about that or not, but where you should go is to this issue of internal consumption.
I would like to address that because I think I briefly touched upon it in my article, and this is a very important point. In coming out of Obama's election, the idea of a new era of Keynesianism, of a government deficit spending to prime the pump, to stoke demand, especially through jobs programs, it was a very seductive idea. You know, the notion—
Green jobs.
Exactly, that we're going to have a green economy. We're going to have wind. We're going to have solar. We're going to have these high-speed rails, alternative energy. But the thing is, and this is where kind of the unmooring of capitalism becomes a problem, you know, that capitalism has really unmoored itself from geography in a lot of ways. Certainly financial capital has. Then merchant and industrial capitalism, they need infrastructure, but they can now just kind of go all over the world. You know, they can bounce from low-wage region to low-wage region. Like Mexico is seeing a huge outflow of jobs. China is even seeing outflows of certain types of industries to lower wage zones. But in terms of the green jobs, okay, suppose we did want to go about and building high-speed rail, hundreds of billions, even trillions were put into something like this. Well, who exactly is going to build it? You have a problem where actually the companies that are most advanced are in China, Germany, and South Korea.
In high-speed rail.
In the trains and in the rail, building the rail systems themselves. So you could end up, you know, there's this argument made, and I even made it at one point that, you know, okay, Obama had this enormous political capital. He was, of course, elected for one reason only, which was to make whole the owning class, to transfer wealth upwards, you know, and that's what he did. He was wildly successful in doing corporate profits at a record rate. But let's suppose that, you know, we had trillions pumped into green jobs, things like high-speed rail. So he would use the leverage over banks and over the auto companies to force them to – the banks to fund this, the auto companies to transition. But could they really compete? We don't have the technological base. We don't have the human intellectual base, the engineering to be able to compete with Germany, South Korea, and China because they've been doing this for years and they're much more advanced. So we'd have to then put tariffs on their goods, and then you start to raise the scenario of a trade war. Of course, then again, maybe we're back in the 1930s and it'll all end in a new world war, which is what really bought the U.S. out of the Great Depression. I mean, I really didn't get into it, but it's worth pointing out that in terms of Keynesianism, it wasn't the New Deal. That was more symbolic, you know, the couple of million young men who were put to work, and it was mainly young men. But if we were to look at what the stimulus of World War II was in today's dollars, $1,000, it would be a $17 trillion stimulus. I think you can make an argument, but we have been down this path, and this path did end disastrously. You know, we've inherited what happened in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s today. So trying to recreate this moment that did fail, you know, and trying to recreate it uncritically is a real problem, you know, and I don't think people are really thinking of all the hidden ideologies that go into, you know, green jobs or defend the middle class.
So Arun Gupta, you're the editor of The Independent. You're in touch with a lot of people, particularly the whole younger dissatisfied generation. What kind of demands do you think should be made if we can't get green jobs and we can't get high-speed rail, we can't even get health care for everybody? What can we organize around? What would you put forward?
I have seen hopeful potential, though it's these movements just pop up and recede so quickly. You know, for a while, I was saying, okay, it's the immigrant rights movement, but it's not clear that there's a lot of mass energy around the immigrant rights movements. You know, there still is a lot of energy, but it's been kind of shunted again into this narrow policy approach. Part of the problem is, you know, we do policy instead of politics in this country. One of the other areas is the climate change movement. There was a huge amount of activism around it a couple of years ago. I think that has a lot of potential. I think a third area would be the food movements. Those aren't overtly political. Some of them are. But this is something where you've seen a huge growth of interest in terms of the politics of consumption and even some of the politics of production, you know, with the successful campaign by the coalition of Immokalee workers who've been able to raise their wages in Florida. They've after a 10-year struggle. We really try to think and find points where are people really organizing around and where it has potential. And that's what we've been able to identify so far. There was a brief spark of hope with the Wisconsin moment, but you know it's been quickly shunted into the graveyard of the Democratic Party, you know, the mausoleum of a great variety of social movements.
Are you involved in trying to organize? Do you encourage people to do that? What do you do politically in addition to putting out a very fine newspaper, The Independent?
I support any sort of organization that has sharp and coherent party politics. There's a group of academics and intellectuals I'm working with. They call themselves the 15th Street Manifesto Group, who are trying to organize some sort of pre-party formation, the most prominent member of which is Stanley Aronowitz. Z Magazine, ZNet, is now trying to do this, organize some sort of movement around the country. There are a couple of, I think, broad-based left-wing formations that I know a lot of people who I respect point to think are doing good work, such as the International Socialist Organization and the Wobblies, IWW.
Dan Gross.
Dan Gross on here. We love Dan. I mean, yeah. And the work that Brand Workers is doing is great.
Right, right, yeah. Of course, you know, we support whatever single issue movements are going on, but you have to have a deeper analysis. And, you know, we have to find out a way of motivating people beyond just very narrow policy prescriptions, which is, I think, a problem that the left tends to fall into. For instance, you know, how did the left find itself in a situation where it's defending the state? Historically, in terms of—
Give an example of that.
We're defending education funding. We're defending health care funding. And I'm not saying that this is unimportant, but when we put our hopes fully, vest them fully in the state as the site of terrain of struggle, I think that's highly problematic. We need to be organized on our own. We need much more of an inside-outside strategy, but the pressures are to just defend these eroding gains constantly. And so you wind up in the cycle where you're just always like, always in crisis management. We have to, you know, defend this from cuts. We have to, then it's defend, you know, this next program from cuts. And you never are able to develop a broader strategy or even a vision that's compelling to people.
And these cuts have been going on, as you state in your article, since 1980. The attack on the teachers and what's going on in Wisconsin is just the latest chapter in what's been a sustained three-decade attack.
Right. And of course, the upward transfer of wealth goes back 50 years. You know, it was Kennedy who started to lower the tax rates. And it was a 91% on the top earners in the 1950s. And I think Kennedy lowered it to something like 79%. So the transfer of wealth, you know, goes back even further because that reduces the ability of the state to fund these services. But again, I don't want to, you know, get involved in the, in this trap of that we need to be looking for the state, because I come out of a Marxist intellectual tradition. What is Marx ultimately talking about? We're fighting for a social revolution, not political revolution, right? We want to change the social relations. And he and Marx also uses the term a free association of producers. That is the ideal society, you know, and in notion in terms of being a stateless society. I understand the need that, yes, we do need to be defending these programs, but we also need a strategy that looks beyond it. And unfortunately, that's the problem, is that we still constantly are appealing to the state, and a state that is, you know, the executive committee of the bourgeoisie.
I want to remind our listeners, we're talking to Arun Gupta, the founding editor of The Independent, and he's here to talk with us about his article, "The American Dream as We Know It is Obsolete: Why Progressives Need to Think Beyond the Mantra of Creating a, quote, middle-class America." Arun, one thing you talk about here is using examples of the Middle East and North Africa as examples for our own kind of organizing and how that can become a model. Can you expand on that a bit?
Those were just were and are truly beautiful moments. Of course, the Arab Spring has taken a very violent and deadly turn, which shouldn't be surprising. But I think especially what we see going on in Tunisia and Egypt, where the revolutions were successful in terms of at least ousting the U.S.-backed dictators, it fundamentally started to transform the social relations, how people saw themselves as agents in society. During a revolution, it is something wonderful. People want to become better people. In Egypt, one of the things that women kept saying is, like, you know, we were able to act in public space, that they could experience themselves as social agents, and not just social agents, but social agents free of sexual harassment, you know, which for them was incredibly liberating. What's going on in Egypt right now is a very fascinating power struggle in terms of who's going to get the upper hand. We actually have an article in the recent issue arguing that the Muslim Brothers are really working hand in glove with the military to try and consolidate control over Egyptian society. But yet we still see from below all these demands that the government is forced to meet, that they had to ditch the last prime minister left in place by Mubarak because of sustained street protests. Incredibly, we've seen the Egyptian military say they're going to end the blockade on Gaza completely, which would be utterly amazing.
It would be amazing. We were amazed by that. And that coupled with the agreement, whatever it actually is, between Hamas and Fatah,
yeah,
which would have never happened under Mubarak. And those two are public demands, really, from the bottom.
Right. So, you know, it is something where people are able to act in social spheres much more. And what we're seeing but not hearing very much about is all the struggles against the little Mubaraks in the universities, in the judiciary, in the factories, you know, that this was a society in which there were dictators all over the place. And a lot of them are being ousted now in the media also, you know. And so there are all these struggles where people are acting to take control of the institutions that affect their lives, you know, real democracy, something that we don't have in this country. You never even hear the term economic democracy in this country, but that's certainly something that the Egyptian labor movement is fighting for right now.
So how would you apply that to here?
I think in terms of Wisconsin, there was a real mistake made in not trying to organize for a general strike. And I point out, like, look, you know, this is not something that's going to happen overnight. You have to have consciousness, you know, in part class consciousness, but there's this whole debate of class consciousness is actually kind of a vague category. But in terms of how are you going to create the momentum for a general strike, you have to engage in all this internal education, all these meetings. You have to create media. You have to create art. You have to go into the community. You have to do alliance building. It's a tremendous amount of one-on-one and group democracy building. And it would have been chaotic. It would have been messy. But it would have also been beautiful and inspiring for people to actually feel like we have control over our own lives. We can imagine something different. We can imagine different power relations, you know, because the only power of labor ultimately is the power to withdraw its labor. And that's what the threat of the general strike is all about. Will the general strike have been successful? We don't know. But I think this whole path of the recalls is just going to end disastrously because elections are authoritarian in nature, right? You have a few Democratic Party stalwarts along with consultants and pollsters and hired guns, lawyers, campaign managers who determine everything. They only want labor for the resources labor has, both in terms of capital and grunt work, you know, people to go out and get petition signs, to do the phone banking, and to stay on message. There is no sort of building of the democratic process, of a democratic culture, of a democratic society that you would see in trying to build for a general strike. And so I think that was just an absolutely grave mistake that was made. But that's the thing, though. I think the Democrats hate mass movements even more than the right. The right likes mass movements like the Tea Party, whereas the Democrats, they hate any mass movement, whether it's right or left.
Gets in the way of the mausoleum, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. And please take a moment to tell our listeners how they can read The Independent, where they can get it physically and where they can get it online.
Well, you can read it online at independent, that's with a Y, independent.org, I-N-D-Y-P-E-N-D-E-N-T. We also distribute about 500 places around New York City. But I would encourage listeners especially to go online to subscribe and especially to donate because we're able to get out almost 20,000 copies of each issue free to the public. This is, to my knowledge, a unique paper in all of the United States. We have very clear, coherent, radical left politics, but we're speaking to the public, not to a self-selected audience of subscribers. And the more money we have, the better reporting we can do and the more people can read the paper. And if we're really going to change things in society, we need the type of media that speaks to the public, that has an intelligent communication and conversation, a dialectical conversation with the public. And that's really one of the things that we're trying to achieve.
Well, thank you, Arun Gupta.
Thank you.
You've got the support of Law and Disorder. We advertise regularly in your paper, and we're going to continue. Thanks for being on the show.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.